Disc 2.
Chapter 4. Munich. Detective Axel Weiss of the Munich Kriminalpolizei was waiting outside Adalbertstrasse 68 2 days later, dressed in civilian clothes and a tan raincoat. He shook Gabriel's hand carefully, as though he were feeling its density. A tall man with a narrow face and a long nose, Weiss's dark complexion and short-cropped black hair gave him the appearance of a Doberman pinscher. He released Gabriel's hand and patted him fraternally on the shoulder.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Herr Landau, though I'm sorry it has to be under these circumstances. Let me take you somewhere comfortable to talk before we go up to the apartment."
They set off down the rain-soaked pavement. It was late afternoon, and the lights of Schwabing were slowly coming up. Gabriel never liked German cities at night. The detective stopped in front of a coffee house and peered through a fogged window. Wood floors, round tables, students and intellectuals hunched over books.
"This will do," he said.
Then he opened the door and led Gabriel to a quiet table in the back.
"Your people at the consulate tell me you own an art gallery."
"Yes, that's right."
"In Tel Aviv."
"You know Tel Aviv?"
The detective shook his head.
"It must be very hard for you now, with the war and all."
"We make do, but then we always have."
A waitress appeared. Detective Weiss ordered 2 coffees.
"Something to eat, Herr Landau?"
Gabriel shook his head. When the waitress was gone, Weiss said,
"Do you have a card?"
He managed to pose the question in an offhand way, but Gabriel could tell his cover story was being probed. His work had left him incapable of seeing things as they appeared to be. When he viewed paintings, he saw not only the surface, but the underdrawings and layers of base paint. The same was true of the people he met in his work for Shamron, and the situations he found himself. He had the distinct impression Axel Weiss was more than just a detective for the Munich Kriminalpolizei. Indeed, Gabriel could feel Weiss's eyes boring into him as he reached into his wallet and produced the business card Shamron had given him in Venice. The detective held it up to the light, as if looking for the marks of a counterfeiter.
"May I keep this?"
"Sure."
Gabriel held open his wallet.
"Do you need any other identification?"
The detective seemed to find this question offensive, and made a grandiose German gesture of dismissal.
"Ach, no, of course not. I'm just interested in art, that's all."
Gabriel resisted the temptation to see how little the German policeman knew about art.
"You've spoken to your people?"
Gabriel nodded solemnly. Earlier that afternoon he had paid a visit to the Israeli consulate for a largely ceremonial briefing. The consular officer had given him a file containing copies of the police reports and clippings from the Munich press. The file was now resting in Ehud Landau's expensive leather briefcase.
"The consular officer was very helpful," Gabriel said. "But if you don't mind, Detective Weiss, I'd like to hear about Benjamin's murder from you."
"Of course,"
the German said. He spent the next 20 minutes giving Gabriel a thorough account of the circumstances surrounding the killing. Time of death, cause of death, caliber of weapon, the well-documented threats against Benjamin's life, the graffiti left on the walls of his flat. He spoke in the calm but forthright manner that police the world over seemed to reserve for the relatives of the slain. Gabriel's demeanor mirrored that of the German detective. He did not feign grief. He did not pretend that the gruesome details of his half-brother's death caused him pain. He was an Israeli. He saw death nearly on a daily basis. The time for mourning had ended. Now was the time for answers and clear-headed thinking.
"Why was he shot in the knee, Detective?"
Weiss pulled his lips down and tilted his narrow head.
"We're not sure. There may have been a struggle, or they may have wanted to torture him."
"But you told me that none of the other tenants heard any sound. Surely if he was tortured, the sound of his screaming would have been audible in other parts of the building."
"As I said, Herr Landau, we're not sure."
Weiss was clearly frustrated by the line of questioning, but Herr Landau, art dealer from Tel Aviv, was not quite finished.
"Is a wound to the knee consistent with other murders carried out by right-wing extremists?" "I can't say that it is."
"Do you have any suspects?"
We're questioning a number of different people in connection with the murder. I'm afraid that's all I can say at the moment.
Have you explored the possibility that his death was somehow linked to his teaching at the university? A disgruntled student, for example. The detective managed to smile, but it was clear his patience was being put to the test.
Your brother was much beloved. His students worshipped him. He was also on sabbatical this term.
The detective paused and studied Gabriel a moment.
You were aware of that, weren't you, Herr Landau?
Gabriel decided it was best not to lie.
No, I'm afraid I wasn't. We haven't spoken in some time.
Why was he on sabbatical?
The chairman of his department told us he was working on a new book.
The detective swallowed the last of his coffee.
Shall we have a look at the apartment now?
I just have one more question.
What's that, Herr Landau?
How did the killer get into his building?
That's one I can answer, Weiss said. Despite the fact that your brother received regular death threats, he lived in a very insecure building. The tenants are very casual about who they let in. If someone presses the intercom and says, "Advertisements," they're routinely buzzed in. A student who lives one floor above, Professor Stern, is fairly certain she was the one who let the killer into the building. She's still very upset. Apparently, she was very fond of him.
They walked back to the apartment building through a steady rain. The detective pressed a button on the intercom panel. Gabriel took note of the corresponding name, Lillian Ratzinger, caretaker. A moment later, a small, fierce-looking woman with hunted brown eyes peered at them around the edge of the door. She recognized Weiss and opened the door to them.
"Good afternoon, Frau Ratzinger," the detective said. "This is Benjamin's brother, Ehud Landau. He's here to put Benjamin's affairs in order."
The old woman glanced at Gabriel and nodded. Then she turned away as if the sight of him made her uneasy. An acidic odor greeted Gabriel in the lobby. It reminded him of the solvents he used to strip dirty varnish from a canvas. He peered around a corner and saw the cosmetic. A fat woman, in the midst of a pedicure, looked up at him over a glossy German fashion magazine. Gabriel turned away. Benjamin, the eternal student, he thought. Benjamin would be comfortable in a place like this. On the wall, adjacent to the door, was a row of metal post-boxes. The one corresponding to Benjamin's flat still bore his name. Through the tiny window, Gabriel could see it was empty. The old woman led them up the dimly lit staircase, a ring of passkeys tinkling in her hand. She paused outside Benjamin's apartment. Tattered remnants of crime scene tape hung from the door jamb, and a mound of dead roses lay on the floor. Taped to the wall was a sign, scrawled in a desperate hand. Liebe ist stärker als Hass. Love is stronger than hate. Something about the idealistic naivete of the slogan angered Gabriel. Then he remembered it was the same thing Leah had said to him before he left for Europe to kill Palestinians for Shamron. Love is stronger than hate, Gabriel. Whatever you do, don't hate them. If you hate them, you'll become just like Shamron. The old woman unlocked the door and left without looking at Gabriel. He wondered about the source of her anxiety. Perhaps it was her age. Perhaps she was of a generation still uncomfortable in the presence of Jews. Weiss led Gabriel into the front room, overlooking the Adalbertstrasse. The afternoon shadows were heavy. The detective illuminated the room by turning on the lamp on Benjamin's desk. Gabriel glanced down, then quickly took a step back. The floor was coated with Benjamin's blood. He looked up at the wall and saw the graffiti for the first time. Detective Weiss pointed to the first symbol, a diamond resting on a pedestal that resembled an inverted V. "This one is known as the Odin rune," Weiss said. "It's an ancient Norse symbol that expresses faith in the pagan religion called Odinism."
"And the second one?" Gabriel asked, though he knew the answer already.
Weiss looked at it a moment before responding. Three numeral sevens, linked at their bases, surrounded by a sea of red.
It's called the Three Sevens, or the Three-Bladed Swastika, the German said. It symbolizes supremacy over the devil as represented by the number 666. Gabriel took a step forward and tilted his head to one side, as though he were inspecting a canvas in need of restoration. To his well-trained eye, it seemed the artist was an imitator rather than a believer. Something else struck him. The symbols of hatred were probably sprayed onto the wall in the moments after Benjamin's murder, yet the lines were straight and perfectly executed, revealing no signs of stress or anxiety. A man used to killing, thought Gabriel, a man comfortable around the dead. He walked over to the desk. Was Benjamin's computer taken as evidence? Weiss shook his head. Stolen. Gabriel looked down at the safe, which was open and empty. Stolen as well, the detective said, anticipating the next question. Gabriel removed a small notebook and pen from his jacket pocket. The policeman sat heavily on the couch, as if he had been walking a beat all day. I have to remain in the flat with you while you conduct your inventory. I'm sorry, but those are the rules. He loosened his tie. Take as much time as you need, Herr Landau. And whatever you do, don't try to take anything, eh? Those are the rules, too. Gabriel could do only so much in the presence of the detective. He started in the bedroom. The bed was unmade, and on the cracked leather armchair was a stack of freshly laundered clothing, still bound in brown paper and string. On the bedside table was a black mask and a pair of foam rubber earplugs. Benjamin, Gabriel remembered, was a notoriously light sleeper. The curtains were heavy and dark, the kind usually kept by someone who works at night and sleeps during the day. When Gabriel drew them, the air was suddenly filled with dust. He spent the next 30 minutes carefully going through the contents of the closet, the dresser, and the bedside table. He made copious notes in his leather-bound notebook, just in case Detective Weiss wanted to have a look at his inventory. In truth, he saw nothing out of the ordinary. He entered the second bedroom. The walls were lined with bookshelves and filing cabinets. Obviously, Benjamin had turned it into a storage room. It looked as though a bomb had exploded nearby. The floor was strewn with books and the file drawers were flung open. Gabriel wondered who was responsible, the Munich police or Benjamin's killer. His search lasted nearly an hour. He flipped through the contents of every file and the pages of every book. Weiss appeared once in the doorway to check on his progress, then yawned and wandered back to the sitting room. Again, Gabriel made abundant notes for the benefit of the detective, but found nothing linking Benjamin to the office, and nothing that might explain why he was murdered. He walked back to the sitting room. Weiss was watching the evening news on Benjamin's television. He switched it off as Gabriel entered. Finished? Did Benjamin have a storage room in the building? The detective nodded. German law requires landlords to provide tenants with one. Gabriel held out his hand. May I have the key? It was Frau Ratzinger who took Gabriel down to the basement and led him along a corridor lined with narrow doorways. She paused at one marked 2B, which corresponded to Benjamin's flat. The old woman opened the door with a grunt and pulled down on the drawstring connected to the overhead light. A moth scattered, brushing Gabriel's cheek. The woman nodded and receded silently down the hallway. Gabriel peered into the storage room. It was little more than a closet, some 4 feet wide and 6 feet deep, and it reeked of linseed oil and damp. A rusted bicycle frame with one wheel, a pair of ancient skis, unlabeled cardboard boxes stacked to a water-stained ceiling. He removed the broken bicycle and the skis and began searching through the boxes of Benjamin's things. In several, he found bound stacks of yellowing papers and old spiral notebooks, the flotsam of a lifetime spent in the lecture halls and libraries of academia. There were boxes of dusty old books, the ones, Gabriel supposed, he deemed too unimportant to place on the shelves in his flat. Several more held copies of Conspiracy Advancée, a reappraisal, Benjamin's last book. The final box contained the purely personal. Gabriel felt like a trespasser. He wondered how he would feel if the roles were reversed, if Shamron had sent someone from the office to rummage through his things. And what would they find? Only what Gabriel wanted them to see. Solvents and pigment, his brushes and his palette, a fine collection of monographs, a Beretta by his bedside. He drew a long breath and proceeded. Inside a cigar box he found a pile of tarnished medals and tattered ribbons, and remembered that Benjamin had been something of a star runner at school. In an envelope were family photographs. Benjamin, like Gabriel, was an only child. His parents had survived the horrors of Riga, only to be killed in a car accident on the road to Haifa. Next he found a stack of letters. The stationery was the colour of honey and still smelled of lilac. Gabriel read a few lines and quickly put the letters aside. Vera, Benjamin's only love. How many nights had he lain awake in some wretched safe flat, listening to Benjamin complain about how the beguiling Vera had ruined him for all other women? Gabriel was quite certain he hated her more than Benjamin had. The last item was a manila file folder. Gabriel lifted the cover, and inside found a stack of newspaper clippings. His eyes flickered over the headlines. 11 Israeli athletes and coaches taken hostage in Olympic Village. Terrorists demand release of Palestinian and German prisoners. Black September. Gabriel closed the file. A black-and-white snapshot slipped out. Gabriel scooped it off the floor. Two boys, blue jeans and rucksacks. A pair of young Germans, spending a summer roaming Europe, or so it appeared. It had been taken in Antwerp, near the river. The one on the left was Benjamin, forelock of wavy hair in his eyes, mischievous smile on his face, his arm flung around the young man standing at his side. Benjamin's companion was serious and sullen, as though he couldn't be bothered with something as trivial as a snapshot. He wore sunglasses, his hair was cropped short, and even though he was not much more than 20 years old, his temples were shot with grey.
"The stain of a boy who's done a man's job," Shamron had said. "Smudges of ash on the Prince of Fire."
Gabriel was not pleased about the file of newspaper clippings on the Munich massacre, but there was no way he could smuggle so large an item past Detective Weiss. The snapshot was different. He wedged it into Herr Landau's expensive wallet and slipped the wallet into his coat pocket. Then he sidestepped his way out of the storage room and closed the door. Frau Ratzinger was waiting in the corridor. Gabriel wondered how long she had been standing there, but dared not ask. In her hand was a small padded shipping envelope. He could see that it was addressed to Benjamin, and that it had been opened. The old woman held it out to him.
"I thought you might want these," she said in German.
"What are they?"
"Benjamin's eyeglasses. He left them at a hotel in Italy. The concierge was good enough to send them back. Unfortunately, they arrived after his death."
Gabriel took the envelope from her, lifted the flap, and removed the eyeglasses. They were the spectacles of an academic, plastic and passé, chewed and scratched. He looked into the envelope once more, and saw there was a postcard. He turned the envelope on end, and the postcard fell into his palm. The image showed an ochre-coloured hotel on a sapphire lake in the north of Italy. Gabriel turned it over and read the note on the back.
"Good luck with your book, Professor Stern. Giancomo."
Detective Weiss insisted on driving Gabriel to his hotel. Because Herr Landau had never before been to Munich, Gabriel was forced to feign awe at the floodlit neoclassical glory of the city centre. He also noted that Weiss skillfully made the trip last 5 minutes longer than necessary by missing several obvious turns. Finally, they arrived in a small cobbled street called the Annastrasse, in the Lahell district of the city. Weiss stopped outside the Hotel Opera, handed Gabriel his card, and once more expressed condolences over Herr Landau's loss.
"If there's anything else I can do for you, please, don't hesitate to ask."
"There is one thing," Gabriel said, I'd like to speak to the chairman of Benjamin's department at the university. Do you have his telephone numbers?
Ah, Dr. Berger, of course.
The policeman removed an electronic organizer from his pocket, found the numbers, and recited them. Gabriel made a point of jotting them down on the back of the detective's card, even though, heard once, they were now permanently engraved in his memory. Gabriel thanked the detective and went upstairs for the night. He ordered room service and dined lightly on an omelet and vegetable soup. Then he showered and climbed into bed with the file given to him that afternoon by the consular officer. He read everything carefully, then closed the file and stared at the ceiling, listening to the night rain pattering against the window.
Who killed you, Benny? A neo-Nazi?
No, Gabriel doubted that. He suspected the Odin rune and 3 sevens painted on the wall were the equivalent of a false flag claim of responsibility. But why was he killed? Gabriel had one working theory. Benjamin was on sabbatical from the university to write another book, yet inside the flat, Gabriel could find no evidence that he was working on anything at all. No notes, no files, no manuscript, just a note written on the back of a postcard from a hotel in Italy. Good luck with your book, Professor Stern, Giancombe. He opened his wallet and removed the photograph he'd taken from the storeroom. Gabriel had been cursed with a memory that allowed him to forget nothing. He could see Benjamin giving his camera to a pretty Belgian girl, feel Benjamin dragging him to the rail overlooking the river. He even remembered the last thing Benjamin had said before throwing his arm around Gabriel's neck.
Smile, you asshole! This isn't funny, Benny.
Can you imagine the look on the old man's face if he saw us posing for a picture?
He'll have your ass for this.
Don't worry, I'll burn it.
5 minutes later, in the bathroom sink, Gabriel did just that. Detective Axel Weiss lived in Bogenhausen, a residential district of Munich on the opposite bank of the Isar. He did not go there. Instead, after dropping the Israeli at his hotel, he parked in the shadows on an adjacent street and watched the entrance of the Hotel Opera. 30 minutes later, he dialed a number in Rome on his cellular phone.
"This is the chief." The words were spoken in English with a pronounced Italian accent. It was always the same. "I think we may have a problem. Tell me everything."
The detective gave a careful recitation of the events of that afternoon and evening. He was experienced at communicating over open phone systems, and was careful not to make any specific references. Besides, the man at the other end knew the specifics.
"Do you have the resources to follow the subject?"
"Yes, but if he's a professional..."
"Do it," snapped the man in Rome, "and get a photograph."
Then the connection went dead. Chapter 5. Vatican City.
"Cardinal Brindisi,
how pleasant to see you."
"Your Holiness."
Cardinal Secretary of State Marco Brindisi bent over the proffered fisherman's ring. His lips did not linger long. He stood upright and stared directly into the Pope's eyes with a confidence bordering on insolence. Thin, with a pinched face and skin like parchment, Brindisi seemed suspended above the floor of the papal apartments. His cassock was handmade by the same tailor near the Piazza della Minerva who made garments for the popes. The solid gold pectoral cross attested to the wealth and influence of his family and patrons. The glint of white light on the small round spectacles concealed a pair of humorless pale blue eyes. As Secretary of State, Brindisi controlled the internal functions of the Vatican city-state, along with its government-to-government relations with the rest of the world. He was, in effect, the Vatican's prime minister and the second most powerful man in the Roman Catholic Church. Despite his disappointing showing at the conclave, the doctrinaire cardinal maintained a carefully cultivated core of support within the Curia that provided him with a power base rivaling even the Pope's. Indeed, the Pope was not at all sure who would prevail in a showdown, himself or the taciturn cardinal. The two men had a regular lunch date, every Friday. It was the part of the Pope's week he dreaded most. Some of his predecessors had relished the minutiae of curial matters, and had spent hours each day slaving over mountains of paperwork. During the reigns of Pius XII and Paul VI, the lights in the papal study had burned well past midnight. Lucchese believed his time was better spent on spiritual matters, and detested dealing with the day-to-day affairs of the Curia. Unfortunately, he did not yet have a Secretary of State whom he trusted, which is why he never missed lunch with Cardinal Brindisi. They sat across from each other in the simple dining room in the papal apartments, the Pope clad in a white soutane and white zucchetto, the Cardinal in a black cassock with a scarlet fascia and zucchetto. As always, Brindisi seemed disappointed with the food. This pleased His Holiness. The Pope knew Brindisi was a gourmand who enjoyed spending his evenings partaking of the gastronomic delights of l'eau vive. As a result, he always asked his nuns to prepare something particularly offensive to the palate. Today the menu consisted of a consommé of indeterminate origin, followed by overdone veal and boiled potatoes. Brindisi pronounced the food inspired, and made a brave show of it. For 45 minutes, Brindisi held forth on a variety of curial matters, each one more tedious than the last. A staff crisis in the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments, a dust-up in the Pontifical Council for the pastoral care of migrants and itinerant people, a report on the monthly meeting of the Vatican Bank officers, allegations a certain Monsignor from the Congregation for the Clergy was misusing his motor pool privileges. Each time Brindisi paused for breath, the Pope murmured, "Ah, how interesting, Eminence," all the while wondering why he was being informed of a problem at the motor pool.
"I'm afraid I need to discuss a matter of some..."
The fussy Cardinal cleared his throat and patted his lips with his napkin.
"Shall we say, unpleasantness, Holiness? Perhaps now is as good a time as any."
"Please, Eminence," the Pope said quickly, eager for any change of subject that might soften the drumbeat of curial monotony, "by all means." Brindisi laid down his fork like a man surrendering after a long siege, and clasped his hands beneath his chin.
"It seems our old friend from La Repubblica is up to no good again. In the course of preparing a long profile on Your Holiness for the newspaper's Easter edition, he has uncovered some..."
A reflective pause, a glance toward the heavens for inspiration.
"Some inconsistencies about your childhood."
"What sort of inconsistencies?"
"Inconsistencies about the date of your mother's death, how old you were when you were orphaned, where you stayed, who cared for you. He is an enterprising reporter, a constant thorn in the side of the Secretariat. He manages to uncover things that we've done our best to bury. I have reiterated to my staff that no one is to talk to him without the approval of the press office, but somehow..."
"People are talking to him."
"That appears to be the case, Holiness."
The Pope pushed away his empty plate and exhaled heavily. It had been his intention to release the full details of his childhood in the days after the conclave, but there were those in the Curia and the press office who thought the world was not ready for a street urchin pope, a boy who had lived by his wits and his fists until he was drawn to the breast of the Church. It was an example of the very culture of secrecy and deceit Lucchese so despised about the Vatican. But in the opening days of his papacy, he had been unwilling to waste valuable political capital, so he reluctantly agreed to paper over some of the less saintly details of his upbringing.
"It was a mistake to tell the world that I grew up in Padua, in a loving home filled with much devotion to Christ and the Virgin, before entering the seminary at 15. Your friend from La Repubblica is going to find the truth."
"Let me deal with La Repubblica. We have ways of bringing wayward journalists into line."
"Such as?"
"Banning them from accompanying Your Holiness on foreign trips, locking them out of press briefings, revoking their privileges at the press office."
"That seems awfully harsh."
"I doubt it will come to that. I'm sure we can convince him of the truth."
Which truth is that?
That you were raised in Padua, in a loving home filled with much devotion to Christ and the Virgin.
Brindisi smiled and brushed an invisible breadcrumb from his cassock.
But when one is battling this sort of thing, it can be helpful to have the complete picture so that we know what we're up against.
What are you suggesting?
A brief memorandum. It will be seen by no one in the Curia but myself, and will be used by me only in the preparation of a defense, should one be warranted.
Did you learn those tactics studying canon law, Marco?
Brindisi smiled.
Some things are universal, Holiness.
A memorandum will be forthcoming.
The Pope and the Cardinal stopped talking as a pair of nuns cleared the table and served espresso. The Pope stirred sugar into his coffee slowly, then looked up at Brindisi.
I have something I wish to discuss as well. It concerns the matter we discussed some months ago, my initiative to continue the process of healing the rift between the Church and the Jews.
How interesting, Holiness.
A man who had spent his career climbing the bureaucratic ladder of the Curia, Brindisi's tone was skillfully non-committal.
As part of that initiative, I intend to commission a study of the Church's response to the Holocaust. All relevant documents in the secret Vatican archives will be made available for review, and this time we will not tie the hands of the historians and experts we select for this project.
Cardinal Brindisi's already pale face shed any remnant of color. He made a church steeple of his forefingers and pressed it to his lips, trying to regain his composure before mounting his challenge.
As you well remember, Holiness, your predecessor commissioned a study and presented it to the world in 1998. I see no need to repeat the work of the Pole when there are so many other, and I dare say, more important issues confronting the Church at this time.
We remember. It should have been called "We apologize," or "We beg forgiveness." It did not go far enough, neither in its soul-searching nor in its search for the truth. It was yet another insult to the very people whose wounds we wish to heal. What did it say? The Church did nothing wrong. We tried to help. Some of us helped more than others. The Germans did the actual killing, not us. But we are sorry in any case. It is a shameful document.
Some might consider it shameful that you are speaking this way about the work of a predecessor.
I have no intention of condemning the efforts of the Pole. His heart was in the right place, but I suspect he did not have the full support of the Curia.
From men like you, thought Lucchesi,
which is why the document ended up saying little, if anything at all. Out of respect for the Pole, I will portray the new study as a continuation of his good work.
Another study will be seen as an implicit criticism, no matter how you attempt to render it.
You were on the panel that drafted "We Remember," were you not?
I was indeed, Holiness.
10 years to write 14 pages.
A consideration and accuracy take time.
So does whitewash.
I object to...
The Pope cut him off.
Do you oppose revisiting the issue because you fear it will bring shame upon the Church, or because you calculate it will damage your chances of taking my place when I'm gone?
Brindisi lowered his hands and lifted his eyes to the ceiling for a moment, as if preparing himself for a reading from the Gospel.
I oppose revisiting the issue because it will do nothing but give more ammunition to those who wish to destroy us.
Our continued deception and evasion is more risky. If we do not speak forcefully and honestly, the work of our enemies will be accomplished by our own hand. We will destroy ourselves.
If I may speak forcefully and honestly, Holiness, your naivete in this matter is shocking. Nothing the Church can say will ever satisfy those who condemn us. In fact, it will only add fuel to the fire. I cannot allow you to tread on the reputation of popes and the Church with this folly.
Pius XII deserves sainthood, not another crucifixion.
Pietro Lucchesi had yet to be seduced by the trappings of papal power, but the blatant insubordination of Brindisi's remark stirred his anger. He forced himself to speak calmly. Even so, there was an edge of rage and condescension in his voice that was plain to the man seated on the other side of the table.
I can assure you, Marco, that those who wish for Pius to be canonized will have to pin their hopes on the outcome of the next conclave.
The cardinal ran a long, spidery finger around the rim of his coffee cup, steeling himself for one more assault on the ridge. Finally, he cleared his throat and said,
The Pole apologized on numerous occasions for the sins of some of the Church's sons and daughters. Other prelates have apologized as well. Some, such as our brethren in France, have gone much further than I would have preferred. But the Jews and their friends in the media will not be satisfied until we admit that we were wrong, that His Holiness Pope Pius XII, a great and saintly man, was wrong. What they do not understand, and what you seem to be forgetting, Holiness, is that the Church, as the embodiment of Christ on earth, cannot be wrong. The Church is truth itself. If we admit that the Church, or a Pope, was wrong.
He left his sentence unfinished, then added, It would be an error for you to go forward with this initiative of yours, Holiness.
A grave error. Behind these walls, Marco, error is a loaded word. Surely it is not your intention to level such an accusation at me?
I have no intention of parsing my words, Holiness.
And what if the documents contained in the secret archives tell a different story?
Those documents must never be released.
I am the only one with the power to release documents from the secret archives, and I have decided that it will be done.
The cardinal fingered his pectoral cross.
When do you intend to announce this initiative?
Next week.
Where?
Across the river, the Pope said, at the great synagogue.
Out of the question. The Curia hasn't had time to give the matter the thought and preparation it deserves.
I'm 72 years old. I don't have time to wait for the mandarins of the Curia to give the matter thought and preparation. That, I'm afraid, is how things are buried and forgotten. The rabbi and I have spoken. I'm going to the ghetto next week, with or without the support of the Curia, or my Secretary of State, for that matter. The truth, Eminence, shall make us free.
And you, the street urchin Pope from the Veneto, pretend to know the truth?
Only God knows the truth, Marco. But Thomas Aquinas wrote of a cultivated ignorance, an ignorantia affectata, a willful lack of knowledge designed to protect one from the harm. It is time to shed our ignorantia affectata. Our Savior said that he was the light of the world, but here in the Vatican we live in darkness. I intend to turn on the lights.
My memory seems to be playing tricks on me, Holiness, but it is my recollection of the conclave that we elected a Catholic Pope.
You did, Eminence, but you also elected a human one. If it were not for me, you would still be wearing red. It is the Holy Spirit who chooses popes. We just cast his ballots.
Another example of your shocking naivete.
Will you be at my side next week in Trastevere?
I believe I'm going to be suffering from the flu next week.
The cardinal stood up abruptly.
Thank you, Holiness. Another pleasant meal.
Until next Friday.
That remains to be seen.
The Pope held out his hand. Cardinal Brindisi looked down at the fisherman's ring shining in the lamplight, then turned around and walked out without kissing it.
Father Donati listened to the quarrel between the Holy Father and the Cardinal from the adjoining pantry. When Brindisi had gone, he entered the dining room and found the Pope looking tired and drawn, eyes closed, thumb and forefinger squeezing the bridge of his nose. Father Donati sat in the Cardinal's chair and pushed away the half-drunk cup of espresso.
"I know that must have been unpleasant, Holiness, but it was necessary."
The Pope finally looked up.
"We have just disturbed a sleeping cobra, Luigi."
"Yes, Holiness."
Donati leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Now let us pray that in its rage the cobra makes a miscalculation and bites itself."
Chapter 6. Munich. Gabriel spent the better part of the following morning trying to track down Dr. Helmut Berger, chairman of the Department of Modern History at Ludwig Maximilian University. He left two messages on the professor's home answering machine, a second on his cellular phone, and a third with a surly secretary in the department. Over lunch in the shadowed courtyard of the hotel, he considered waiting in ambush outside the professor's office. Then the concierge appeared with a message slip in his hand. The good professor had agreed to meet with Herr Landau at 6:30 at a restaurant called the Gestatter Arzinger on the Amalienstrasse. That left 5 hours to kill. The afternoon was clear and blustery, so Gabriel decided to take a walk. Leaving the hotel, he wandered up a narrow cobblestone street that led to the southern end of the English Gardens. He moved slowly along the footpaths beside shaded streams, across broad sunlit lawns. In the distance, the 1,000-foot spire of the Olympia Tower sparkled against the crystalline blue sky. Gabriel lowered his gaze and kept walking. Leaving the park, he drifted through Schwabing. In the Adalbertstrasse, he saw Frau Ratzinger sweeping the steps of number 68. He had no wish to speak to the old woman again, so he rounded a corner and headed in the opposite direction. Every few minutes he would look up and glimpse the tower looming before him, growing larger by degrees. 10 minutes later, he found himself at the southern end of the village. In many ways, Olympia Park was just that, a village, a vast residential area complete with its own railway station, its own post office, even its own mayor. The cement block bungalows and apartment houses had not aged gracefully. In an attempt to brighten up the place, many of the units had been painted in bright tie-dye patterns. He came upon the Connollystrasse. It was not a street, really, but a pedestrian walkway, lined with small three-story apartment houses. At number 31, he stopped walking. On the second floor, a bare-chested teenager stepped onto the balcony to shake out a throw rug. Gabriel's memory flashed. Instead of a young German, he saw a Palestinian in a balaclava. Then a woman emerged from the ground-floor apartment, pushing a stroller and clutching a child to her breast. For an instant, Gabriel saw Issa, leader of the Black September team, his face covered in boot polish, swaggering about in his safari suit and golf hat. The woman looked at Gabriel as though she was used to strangers standing outside her home with disbelieving expressions on their faces. "Yes," she seemed to be saying. "Yes, this is the place where it happened, but now it's my home, so please go." She seemed to sense something else in his gaze, something that unnerved her, and she quickly strapped the child into the stroller and headed toward a playground. Gabriel climbed a grassy hillock and sat in the cool grass. Usually when the memories came, he tried desperately to push them away, but now he unchained the door and allowed them to enter. Romano, Springer, Spitzer, Slavin, the faces of the dead flashed through his memory. 11 in all, 2 killed in the takeover, 9 more during the bungled German rescue attempt at Fürstenfeldbruck. Golda Meir wanted revenge of biblical proportions, an eye for an eye, and she ordered the office to send forth the boys to hunt down the members of Black September who had plotted the attack. A brash operations officer named Ari Shamron was placed in charge of the mission, and one of the boys he came for was a promising young student at Jerusalem's Bezalel School of Art named Gabriel Alon.
Somehow, Shamron had come across the file from Gabriel's unhappy compulsory service in the army. The child of Auschwitz survivors, Gabriel was found arrogant and selfish by his superiors, prone to periods of melancholia, but also highly intelligent and capable of taking independent action without waiting for guidance from commanding officers. He was also multilingual, an attribute that had little value in a frontline infantry unit, but was much sought after by Ari Shamron. His war would not be fought in the Golan or the Sinai. It would be a secret war, waged in the shadows of Europe. Gabriel had tried to resist him. Shamron left him no choice.
Once again, Jews are dying on German soil with their hands tied behind their backs, Shamron had said. Your parents survived, but how many didn't? Their brothers and sisters, their aunts and uncles, grandparents, they're all gone, aren't they? Are you really going to sit here in Tel Aviv with your brushes and your paints and do nothing? You have gifts. Let me borrow them for a few months. Then you can do whatever you want with your life.
The mission was codenamed Operation Wrath of God. In the lexicon of the unit, Gabriel was an Aleph, an assassin. The agents who tracked Black Septembrists and learned their habits were codenamed Ayin. A Kof was a communications officer. Benjamin Stern had been a Heth, a logistician. His job was to procure transport and lodging in ways that could never be traced to the office. Sometimes he doubled as a getaway driver. Indeed, Benjamin had been behind the wheel of the green Fiat that carried Gabriel away from the Piazza Annibaliano the night he assassinated Black September's chief in Italy. On the way to the airport, Gabriel had forced Benjamin to pull to the side of the road so he could be sick. Even now he could hear Benjamin shouting at him to get back into the car.
Give me a minute. You'll miss your flight. I said give me a minute. What's wrong with you? That bastard deserved to die. You didn't see his face, Benny. You didn't see his fucking face.
Over the next 18 months, Shamron's team assassinated a dozen members of Black September. Gabriel personally killed 6 men. When it was over, Benjamin resumed his academic career. Gabriel tried to go back to Bezalel and do the same, but his ability to paint had been chased away by the ghosts of the men he had killed. So he left Leia behind in Israel and moved to Venice to study restoration with Umberto Conti. In restoration, he found healing. Conti, who knew nothing of Gabriel's past, seemed to understand this. Late at night he would come to Gabriel's room in a sagging pensione and drag him into the streets of Venice to look at art. One evening, standing before the great Titian altarpiece in the Frari church, he seized Gabriel by the arm.
A man who is pleased with himself can be an adequate restorer, but not a great restorer. Only a man with a damaged canvas of his own can truly be a great restorer. It is a meditation for you. A ritual. One day you will be a great restorer. You will be better than I am. I'm sure of it.
And though Conti did not know it, those were the same words Shamron had said to Gabriel the night before he sent him to Rome to kill his first Palestinian. Gabriel was standing outside the Gestette Atzinger at 6:30 sharp. The first thing he saw of Professor Helmut Berger was the headlamp on his bicycle, floating above the Amalienstrasse. Then his form appeared, legs pumping rhythmically, his thinning grey hair floating above his large ears like wings. A brown leather satchel hung across his back. The endearing quality of the professor's arrival evaporated in short order. Like many German intellectuals, Helmut Berger had the put-upon air of a man who had spent the day grappling with beings of inferior intelligence. He claimed to have time only for a small glass of beer, but he invited Gabriel to select something from the menu. Gabriel ordered only mineral water, which the German seemed to find deeply scandalous.
I'm very sorry about your brother. Excuse me, your half-brother. He was a valuable member of the faculty. His death was a shock to us all.
He spoke these lines without genuine emotion, as though they had been written for him by a graduate student.
How can I help you, Herr Landau?
Is it true that Benjamin was on a sabbatical at the time of his murder?
Yes, that's correct. He was working on another book.
Do you know the subject of that book?
Actually, I don't.
Really? Gabriel was genuinely surprised. Is it typical for someone to leave your department to work on a book without telling you the subject matter?
No, but Benjamin was very secretive about this project from the very beginning.
Gabriel decided he could not press the issue. Did you know anything about the kind of threats Benjamin received?
There were so many, it was hard to keep them straight. Benjamin's theories about the collective German wartime guilt made him, shall we say, highly unpopular in many quarters.
It sounds to me as though you didn't share Benjamin's views. The professor shrugged.
A few years ago, I wrote a book on the role of the German Catholic Church during the war. Benjamin disagreed with my conclusions and said so in a very public manner. It was not a pleasant time for either of us.
The professor looked at his watch.
I'm afraid I have another engagement. Is there anything else I can tell you? Perhaps something more relevant to your inquiries?
Last month, Benjamin made a trip to Italy. Do you happen to know why he went there? Was it connected to the book in any way?
I have no idea. You see, Dr. Stern didn't make a habit of giving me advance warning about his travel plans.
The professor finished the last of his beer and stood up. Class dismissed.
Again, my condolences, Herr Landau. I wish you luck with your inquiries.
Like hell you do, thought Gabriel, as he watched Professor Berger walk outside and pedal away. On the way back to his hotel, Gabriel entered a large student bookstore on the southern edge of the university district. He gazed at the store directory for a moment, and then climbed the stairs to the travel section, where he searched a display bin filled with maps until he came across one for northern Italy. He spread it over a nearby table, then reached into his pocket and removed the postcard. The hotel where Benjamin had stayed was in a town called Brenzone. Judging from the photograph, the town was set on the shoreline of one of Italy's northern lakes. He started in the west and worked his way slowly eastward, reading the names of the towns and villages surrounding each of the great northern lakes, first Maggiore, then Como, then Iseo, then finally Garda. Brenzone. There it was, on the eastern shore of the Lago di Garda, about halfway between the bulge at the southern end and the dagger-like northern tip. Gabriel refolded the map and carried it downstairs to the cash register. A moment later, he stepped back through the revolving doors into the street, the map and postcard resting in his jacket pocket. Instinctively, his eyes flickered over the pavement, the parked cars, the windows of the surrounding buildings. He turned left and started back to his hotel, wondering why Detective Axel Weiss had been sitting in the cafe across the street the entire time Gabriel was in the bookstore, and why he was now following him across the center of Munich. Gabriel was confident he could easily evade or expose the German detective, but now was not the time to betray the fact that he was a trained professional. As far as Axel Weiss knew, Gabriel was Ehud Landau, brother of slain historian Benjamin Stern, and nothing else, which made the fact that he was following him all the more curious. He entered a hotel on the Maximilianstrasse. He made a brief call on a public telephone in the lobby, then went back outside and kept walking. The policeman was still there, 50 meters back, on the opposite side of the street. Gabriel walked directly to his hotel. He collected his key from the clerk at the front counter and rode the lift up to his room. He packed his clothing into a garment bag of black leather, then unlocked the room safe and removed the file he had been given by the Israeli consulate, along with the envelope containing Benjamin's eyeglasses. He placed the items in the briefcase and closed the lid. Then he switched off the room lights, walked to the window, and parted the curtain. A car was parked just up the street. Gabriel could see the glow of a cigarette ember behind the wheel. Weiss. Gabriel closed the curtain and sat on the end of the bed, waiting for the phone to ring. 20 minutes later, Landau. It's at the corner of the Seitzstrasse and the Unsolstrasse, just south of Prinzregenten. Do you know where that is?
Yes,
Gabriel said. Give me the number. 9 digits. Gabriel did not bother to write them down. The keys. Standard location, back bumper, curbside. Gabriel hung up, pulled on his jacket, and collected his bags. In the lobby, he explained to the night clerk that he was checking out ahead of schedule.
Do you require a taxi, Herr Landau?
No, I'm being picked up. Thank you.
A bill slid toward him across the counter. Gabriel paid with one of Shamron's credit cards and went out. He turned left and started walking quickly, garment bag in one hand, briefcase in the other. 20 seconds later, he heard the sound of a car door opening and closing, followed by footsteps on the wet cobblestones of the Annastrasse. He maintained his steady pace, resisting the impulse to look over his shoulder.
Corner of the Seidstrasse and the Unsoldstrasse.
Gabriel passed a church, turned left and paused in a small square to take his bearings. Then he turned right and followed another narrow street toward the sound of the traffic rushing along the Prinzregentenstrasse. Weiss was still trailing him. He walked along a line of parked cars reading registration numbers, until he came across the one he'd just been given over the phone. It was attached to a dark grey Opel Omega. Without stopping, he bent slightly at the waist and ran his fingers beneath the rear bumper until he found the keys. With a movement so brief and smooth that Weiss seemed not to notice, Gabriel tore the keys loose. He pressed the button on the remote. The doors unlocked automatically. Then he opened the driver's side door and threw his bags onto the passenger seat. He looked to his right. Weiss was running toward him, panic on his face. Gabriel climbed inside, rammed the keys into the ignition, and started the engine. He dropped the car into gear and pulled away from the curb, then turned hard to the right and vanished into the evening traffic. Detective Axel Weiss had leapt out of his car so quickly that he had left his cellular phone behind. He ran all the way back, then paused to catch his breath before dialing the number. A moment later, he broke the news to the man in Rome that the Israeli called Landau was gone.
How?
Embarrassed, Weiss told him.
Did you get a photograph, at least?
Earlier today, at the Olympic Village.
The village? What on earth was he doing there?
Staring at the apartment house at Connollystrasse 31.
Wasn't that where it happened?
Yes, that's right. It's not unusual for Jews to make a pilgrimage there.
Is it usual for Jews to detect surveillance and execute a perfect escape?
Point taken. Send me the photograph. Tonight.
Then the man in Rome severed the connection. Chapter 7. Near Rieti, Italy. There is an unsettling beauty about the Villa Galatina. A former Benedictine abbey, it stands atop a column of granite in the hills of Lazio and stares disapprovingly down at the village on the floor of the wooded valley. In the 17th century, an important cardinal purchased the abbey and converted it into a lavish summer residence, a place where His Eminence could escape the broiling heat of Rome in August. His architect had possessed the good sense to preserve the exterior, and its tawny-colored facade remains to this day, along with the teeth of the battlements. On a morning in early March, a man was visible high on the wind-swept parapet. It was not a bow over his shoulder, but a high-powered Beretta sniper's rifle. The current owner was a man who took his security seriously. His name was Roberto Pucci, a financier and industrialist whose power over modern Italy rivaled that of even a Renaissance prince of the church. An armored Mercedes sedan stopped at the steel gate, where it was greeted by a pair of tan-suited security guards. The man seated in the back compartment lowered his window. One of the guards examined his face, then glanced at the distinctive SVC license plates on the Mercedes. Vatican plates. Roberto Pucci's gate swung open, and an asphalt drive lined with cypresses stretched before them. A quarter mile up the hillside was the villa itself. The Mercedes eased up the drive and pulled into a gravel forecourt shaded by umbrella pine and eucalyptus. 2 dozen other cars were already there, surrounded by a small army of security men and chauffeurs.
The man in the back seat climbed out, leaving his own bodyguard behind, and walked across the courtyard toward the bell tower of the chapel. His name was Carlo Casagrande. For a brief time in Italy, his name had been a household word, for it was General Carlo Casagrande, chief of the anti-terrorist unit of l'Arma dei Carabinieri, who had crushed the communist Red Brigades. For reasons of personal security, he was notoriously camera-shy, and few people outside the Rome intelligence community would have recognized his face. Casagrande no longer worked for the Carabinieri. In 1981, a week after the attempt to assassinate Pope John Paul II, he resigned his commission and vanished behind the walls of the Vatican. In a way, Casagrande had been working for the men of the Holy See all along. He took control of the security office, vowing that no pope would ever again leave St. Peter's Square in the back of an ambulance, praying to the Virgin Mary for his life. One of his first acts was to launch a massive investigation into the shooting, so that the conspirators could be identified and neutralized before they were able to mount a second attempt on the Pope's life. The findings of the inquiry were so sensitive that Casagrande shared them with no one but the Holy Father himself. Casagrande was no longer directly responsible for protecting the life of the Pope. For the last 3 years, he had been engaged in another task for his beloved church. He remained attached to the Vatican Security Office, but it was only a flag of convenience to give him standing in certain quarters. He was now the head of the vaguely named Special Investigations Division. So secret was Casagrande's assignment, only a handful of men within the Vatican knew the true nature of his work. Casagrande entered the chapel. Cool air, scented with candle wax and incense, caressed his face. In the sanctuary he dipped his fingers in holy water and made the sign of the cross. Then he walked up the center aisle toward the altar. To call it a chapel was an understatement. It was, in fact, a rather large church, larger than the parish churches in most of the nearby towns. Casagrande took his place in the first pew. Roberto Pucci, dressed in a gray suit and an open-necked white shirt, nodded at him from across the aisle. Despite his 75 years, Pucci still radiated an aura of physical invincibility. His hair was white and his face the color of oiled saddle leather. He appraised Casagrande coldly with a pair of hooded black eyes. The Pucci stare. Whenever Pucci looked at you, it was as if he was deciding whether to stab you in the heart or slit your throat. Like Carlo Casagrande, Roberto Pucci was an uomo di fiducia, a man of trust. Only laymen with a unique skill valued by the men of the Vatican were allowed into its innermost chambers. Casagrande's expertise was security and intelligence. Pucci's was money and political power. He was the hidden hand in Italian politics, a man so influential that no government could form without first making a pilgrimage to the Villa Galatina to secure his blessing. But few people in the Italian political establishment knew that Pucci maintained a similar grip over another Roman institution, the Vatican. His power at the Holy See derived from his covert management of a substantial portion of the vast stock and real estate holdings of the Catholic Church. Under Pucci's sure hand, the net worth of the Vatican's portfolios had experienced explosive growth. Unlike his predecessors, he had achieved this feat without a whiff of scandal. Casagrande glanced over his shoulder. The others were scattered in the remaining pews. The Italian foreign minister, an important bishop from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the chief of the Vatican press office, an influential conservative theologian from Cologne, an investment banker from Geneva, the leader of a far-right party in France, the owner of a Spanish media conglomerate, the chief of one of Europe's largest automakers. A dozen more, very much in the same mold, all doctrinaire Catholics, all wielding enormous political or financial power, all dedicated to restoring the Church to the position of supremacy it had enjoyed before the calamity of the Reformation. Casagrande found it vaguely amusing when he overheard debates about where true power resided within the Roman Catholic Church. Did it rest with the Synod of Bishops, the College of Cardinals?
Did it rest in the hands of the Supreme Pontiff himself?
No, thought Casagrande.
True power in the Catholic Church resided here, in this chapel, on a mountainside outside Rome, in the hands of this secret brotherhood. A cleric strode onto the altar, a cardinal clad in the ordinary vestments of a parish priest. The members rose to their feet, and the mass commenced.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen.
The cardinal led them briskly through the introductory rites, the penitential rite, the Kyrie and the Gloria. He celebrated the Tridentine Mass, for it was one of the goals of the Brotherhood to restore what it deemed the unifying force of the Latin liturgy. The homily was the typical fare of gatherings such as this, a call to arms, a warning to remain steadfast in the face of enemies, a plea to stamp out the corrosive forces of liberalism and modernism within society and the Church itself. The cardinal did not mention the name of the Brotherhood. Unlike its close relatives, Opus Dei, the Legions of Christ, and the Society of St. Pius X, it did not officially exist, and its name was never spoken. Among themselves, the members referred to it only as the Institute. Casagrande had heard the sermon many times before, and he allowed his mind to drift. His thoughts turned to the situation in Munich, and the report he had received from his operative about the Israeli called Landau. He sensed further trouble, an ominous threat to the Church and the Brotherhood itself. He required the blessing of the Cardinal and the money of Roberto Pucci to deal with it.
Hic est enim calix sanguinis mei,
the Cardinal recited, for this is the chalice of my blood of the New and Eternal Testament, the mystery of faith, which shall be shed for you and for many unto the remission of sins. Casagrande's attention returned to the Mass. 5 minutes later, when the liturgy of the Eucharist was complete, he rose to his feet and filed toward the altar behind Roberto Pucci. The financier received the sacrament of communion, then Casagrande stepped forward. Cardinal Secretary of State Marco Brindisi held the host aloft, stared directly into Casagrande's eyes, and said in Latin, "May the body of our Lord Jesus Christ keep your soul unto life everlasting." Carlo Casagrande whispered, "Amen." Business was never discussed in the chapel. That was reserved for a sumptuous buffet lunch, served in a large gallery hung with tapestries overlooking the terrace. Casagrande was distracted and had no appetite. During his long war against the Red Brigades, he had been forced to live in hiding in a series of underground bunkers and military barracks, surrounded by the rough company of his staff officers. He had never grown used to the luxurious privilege of life behind the Vatican walls, nor did he share the enthusiasm of the other guests for Roberto Pucci's food. He pushed a piece of smoked salmon around his plate, while Cardinal Brindisi deftly conducted the meeting. Brindisi was a lifelong Vatican bureaucrat, but he loathed the circular logic and duplicity that characterized most discussions inside the Curia. The Cardinal was a man of action, and there was a boardroom quality to the way he presided over the agenda. Had he not become a priest, thought Casagrande, he might very well have been Roberto Pucci's fiercest competitor. The men seated round the room considered democracy a messy and inefficient means of governance, and the Brotherhood, like the Roman Catholic Church itself, was no democracy. Brindisi had been entrusted with power and would wield it until his death. In the lexicon of the Institute, each man in the room was a director. He would return home and hold a similar gathering with the men who reported to him. In that way, Brindisi's orders would be dispersed throughout the vast organization. There was no tolerance for creativity or independent action among middle management. Members were sworn to absolute obedience. Casagrande's work was never discussed among the directorate. He spoke only in executive session, which in this case consisted of a stroll through the magnificent terraced gardens of the Villa Galatina, with Brindisi and Pucci during a break in the proceedings. Brindisi walked with his chin up and his fingers interlaced across his abdomen, Casagrande on his left, Pucci on his right, the three most powerful men in the Brotherhood, Brindisi, spiritual leader, Pucci, Minister of Finance, Casagrande, Chief of Security and Operations. The members of the Institute privately referred to them as the Holy Trinity. The Institute did not have an intelligence section of its own. Casagrande was beholden to a small cadre of Vatican policemen and Swiss guards loyal to him and the Brotherhood. His legendary status among the Italian police and intelligence forces gave him access to their resources as well. In addition, he had built a worldwide network of intelligence and security officials, including a senior administrator of the American FBI, all willing to do his bidding. Axel Weiss, the Munich detective, was a member of Casagrande's network. So was the Minister of the Interior in the heavily Catholic state of Bavaria. At the suggestion of the minister, Weiss had been assigned to the Stern case. He had removed sensitive material from the historian's apartment and had controlled the direction of the investigation. Stern's assassination had been linked to neo-Nazis, just as Casagrande had intended. Now, with the appearance of the Israeli called Landau, he feared the situation in Munich was beginning to unravel. He expressed his concerns to Cardinal Brindisi and Roberto Pucci in the garden of the Villa Galatina.
"Why don't you just kill him?"
Pucci said in his gravelly voice.
"Yes, kill him," thought Casagrande. "The Pucci solution."
Casagrande had lost count of how many murders had been linked to the shadowy financier. He chose his words carefully, for he had no wish to openly cross swords with him. Pucci had once ordered a man killed for leering at Pucci's daughter, and his assassins were far more skilled than the fanatical children of the Red Brigades.
"We took a calculated risk by liquidating Benjamin Stern, but it was forced upon us by the material in his possession."
Casagrande spoke in a measured, deliberate manner.
"Based upon the actions of this man Landau, it is now safe to conclude that the Israeli Secret Service does not believe the murder of their former operative was carried out by a neo-Nazi extremist." "Which brings us back to my original suggestion," Pucci interrupted. "Why don't you just kill him?" "This is not the Italian service that I'm talking about, Don Pucci. This is the Israeli service. As director of security, it is my job to protect the Institute. In my opinion, it would be a grave mistake to involve us in a shooting war with the Israeli Secret Service. They have assassins of their own, assassins who have killed on the streets of Rome and slipped away without a trace."
Casagrande looked across the cardinal toward Pucci. "Assassins who could penetrate the walls of this old abbey, Don Pucci." Cardinal Brindisi played the role of the mediator.
"Then how do you suggest we proceed, Carlo?"
"Carefully, Eminence. If he is truly an agent of Israeli intelligence, then we can use our friends in the European security services to make life very uncomfortable for him. In the meantime, we must make sure there's nothing else for him to find."
Casagrande paused, then added, "I'm afraid we have one loose end remaining. After examining the material taken from Professor Stern's apartment, I've come to the conclusion he was working with a collaborator, a man who's given us problems in the past." A look of annoyance rippled over the cardinal's face, a stone cast into a calm pond at sunrise. Then his features regained their composure.
"And the other aspects of your inquiry, Carlo? Are you any closer to identifying the brethren who leaked these documents to Professor Stern in the first place?"
Casagrande gave a frustrated shake of his head. How many hours had he spent sifting the material taken from the flat in Munich? Notebooks, computer files, address books. Casagrande had gone over everything, looking for clues to the identity of the individuals or group who'd given the information to the professor. Thus far, he'd found nothing. The professor had covered his tracks well. It was as if the documents had been handed to him by a ghost.
"I'm afraid that element of the case remains a mystery, Eminence. If this act of treachery was perpetrated by someone inside the Vatican, we may never know the truth. The Curia happens to be good training ground for intrigues of this sort."
This remark elicited a flicker of a smile from Brindisi. They walked in silence for a moment. The cardinal's eyes were down.
2 days ago, I had lunch with the Holy Father.
he said finally. As we suspected, His Holiness intends to go forward with his program of reconciliation with the Jews. I tried to dissuade him, but it was useless. He's going to the great synagogue of Rome next week.
Roberto Pucci spat at the ground. Carlo Casagrande exhaled heavily. He was not surprised by the cardinal's news. Casagrande and Brindisi had a source on the Holy Father's staff, a secretary who was a member of the Brotherhood and kept them apprised of developments inside the Appartamento. He had been warning for weeks that something like this was coming.
"He is a caretaker pope," Pucci snapped. "He needs to learn his place."
Casagrande held his breath, waiting for Pucci to suggest his favorite solution to a problem, but not even Pucci would consider such an option.
"The Holy Father is not content simply to issue another statement of remorse over our past differences with the Jews. He intends to throw open the secret archives as well."
"He can't be serious," said Casagrande.
"I'm afraid he's very serious. The question is, if he throws open the archives, will the historians find anything?"
"The archives have been purged of all references to the meeting at the convent. As for the witnesses, they've been dealt with and their personnel files destroyed. If the Holy Father insists on commissioning a new study, the archives will yield no new damaging information whatsoever. Unless, of course, the Israeli manages to reconstruct the work of Professor Stern. If that happens,
then the Church and the Institute will find itself in very difficult straits," said the Cardinal, finishing Casagrande's sentence for him. "For the greater good of the Church and all those who believe in her, the secret of the covenant must remain just that, a secret."
"Yes, Eminence." Roberto Pucci lit a cigarette. "Perhaps our friend in the Appartamento can advise the Holy Father to see the error of his ways, Eminence."
"I've tried that route already, Don Pucci. According to our friend, the Pope is determined to proceed, regardless of the advice of his secretaries or the Curia."
"From a financial point of view, the Holy Father's initiative could be disastrous," Pucci said, switching his focus from murder to money. "Many people wish to do business with the Vatican because of its good name. If the Holy Father drags that good name through the mud of history..."
Brindisi nodded in agreement.
"In private, the Holy Father often expresses a desire to return to the days of a poor church."
"If he's not careful," said Pucci, "he'll get his wish."
Cardinal Brindisi looked at Casagrande.
"This collaborator," the Cardinal said, "you believe he poses a threat to us?"
"I do, Eminence."
"What do you require of me, Carlo? Other than my approval, of course."
"Just that, Eminence."
"And from Don Pucci?"
Casagrande looked into the hooded black eyes.
"I need his money."
This book is continued on Disc 3.